Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to episode 3001 with Kurt Weller and Bob Knopf.
Good evening, everybody, or afternoon, depending on where you're at, or early morning or noon. It is June 7th, 2010, 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and going to do another show here, another episode of episode 3001 with Kurt Weller and Bob Dobbs. And I'm just waiting for Bob to call in. This weekend, I've been working out a lot, doing some exercises, and been taking some supplements. I've added potassium and lysine to my diet, as well as a multivitamin called, it's from Trader Joe's. It's called like Super Evolution or something like that. And I've been feeling it. I've been feeling better. Been feeling back on my game, if you will. And that is a good feeling, to be back on one's game. Bob.
Hey, Kurt. Are you there, Kurt?
Yes, I am. How you doing, Bob?
Okay, it's nice to call in and hear Dave Neufeld's interpretation of me. It's always fun to hear that. It's an eternal riff.
Yeah, like
which one were you playing?
The Bobby one.
Oh, okay. And then what'd you say? You go, what do I mean by eternal riff?
Yeah.
You weren't saying it is an eternal riff. You said, what do you mean by eternal riff?
That's what I said.
Yeah, I'd say the head staying power. Sort of a unique sound. It's always fresh.
Oh, okay, that's what you mean by an eternal riff. Yeah, it always sounds good.
Yeah. I don't know if I listened to it every day, if it would, but whenever I hear it, I get a nice feeling from it.
Every day, I get a nice feeling. Yeah. That's crazy every day.
Yeah, but I get a nice feeling whenever I hear the album, which might be once every 2 years or something.
That's good.
Yeah. Most, you know, I don't listen to Zappa that much, but when I do, it reminds me of the value of Zappa.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's some things you revisit every once in a while, and you remember how sweet it was.
But not just was, it remains sweet. It remains powerful. It is. Like when I listen to Zap, I say, well, obviously this is the greatest musician who ever lived. That's my thinking while I'm listening. And
there's
then,
I'm like that too. There's a lot of things that I listen to. When I'm listening to it, I think this is the greatest thing I've ever seen or heard or whatever. And it kind of switches off.
Now, that's a good point here, because the electric age, you know, the instantaneity of having that injection into your being, into your head, ears, whatever, there's so much of that good stuff, and you can't determine whether it's the electrical medium itself or what, but if you've got the great, your temperament, you like certain kind of music, or I don't know, you don't even know what you like. I have great experiences all the time, including stuff I didn't like when it first came out. So I don't consider that hit of feeling good from something and liking it important, because when I get a hit from Zappa, it is deeper and richer than the ecstasy I get from something nice that I like. That's different. I think that any music that's electrified, it's probably anybody can like anything. You know, it's like McClellan said, rock and roll is not just music. It's an environment. So you got this electric effect. So it doesn't matter what music's on there, the enjoyment of everybody thinking that everybody's hearing at the same time enjoying it, which was the common feeling in the 50s, 60s, 70s, that emotion of multitude is what is largely being communicated. And that's why they brought in Paola and the Mafia guys ran the record industry, because they knew it didn't matter who was on there, so they just had their guys on there. It wasn't a matter of quality, just whatever's on there, and the kids hear it, you know, they're in school and they go home. Or nowadays, they aren't either of those places, home or school, but wherever they are, they tune in, they get their hit. And it doesn't matter, you know, they get to simulate, it doesn't matter what it is generally. Now, there are different temperaments, but there's such a range of variety that you'll like something. And so how do you become extraordinary communication in that situation? And I think Zappa did it. When I used to go to live concerts with him, halfway through, I'd say, this is a UFO. This is an unidentified, now identified flying object. It was that intense.
So, what do you think about? So, is it too late? I mean, is it over? I mean, No.
The kids still get electric hit. You know, they still turn on the radio, whatever they use, their iPhones, and they like music. You know, a kid's a young mind. Maybe superior in ion sense, superior, but they get the hit. That's what my chart means. You go through the phases of enjoying the electric effect. Now, the other thing is that what's interesting, you get that feeling, a richer feeling from Zappa, but when it's turned off and I go do something else, it's quickly forgotten, even though it's the greatest thing while you're doing it.
Right, and exactly.
That's the interesting. Now, this is a whole new way to experience pleasure. This is what McLuhan and Joyce were getting at. What is it doing to us, to our values, or to what we think is good or important or significant, if you have this strange thing that even the greatest stuff, like for me, Zappa, it falls away when you turn off the radio or turn off whatever you're listening to it on? That's a strange thing.
So what is that? I mean... And what my point earlier was, what is there going to be any one kind of person or media entity that's going to be able to dominate, like say the Beatles did? In this
well,
they're
always
is that even possible?
Well, not on the mass level, but there's always that for young minds who are just consuming, young ears. Now, they might even be mutating differently because, you know, it's a way different situation in the technological mix than 30, 20 years ago. So the music will change. It always changes to fit the sensibilities that the hidden technological medium is conditioning people to. That's not a negative conditioning. It's just massaging you. So the music changes, and you can look through all the different – that's what I have in my chart. You know, I've got jazz for the 40s and 50s, and then I got rock and roll – but basically Elvis and the Beatles, and then rock, and then disco, and then punk, and then rap or hip-hop. So those changes are, you can map the reason they're happening. I've done this with you before. I've run through the phases and how they meet the needs of their particular decade. But the overall thing is, no, you don't stop the kids. They still want that's why we say they have a body, a TV body, a chip body. They still are going to engage that body. And the industry, music industry, will run on that. Even though it's hard to dominate the way the Beatles did, but for kids, they do have a dominance, whatever they're into. It becomes very important. So
right. Back
then, when the Beatles were here, they were just one good group among many for me and people I knew. Like there was the Searchers, the Zombies, the Stones, the then the silly songs, the Herman's Hermits and those things. And then there was Smokey Robinson. It was the Beatles who did not stand out, in my experience. Now, I was
I wasn't there, and I never cared for him anyway. When I'd hear it, like, later, you know, like a lot of people my age are really into him, and I can never understand it because, you know, it doesn't seem relevant.
That's right. Now, I'm doing this dialogue with Scott Woods on, it's called rockcritics.com, and we're going through The Aesthetics of Rock by Richard Meltzer. Do you know that book?
You've mentioned it before, yeah.
Yeah. It's incredible. I think I'm explaining the rock experience and pop culture musical enjoyment in a way it's never been done before, you know, building on McLuhan and other things. And I have friends who listen to it and say, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard, Bob. And they're talking about understanding the culture. And what we're talking about right now is something I think about all the time, about what is this strange phenomenon? How does one verbalize a statement about it? So let's see. So back in the 60s, when it was just all this great music, for some people, mostly young people, adults didn't like it. But I was older. I was an adult, but I liked R&B for some reason when I came over in the 50s. And that just opened me up to, I don't care if this is kids' music, it's great. And so then I was open to kids' music. And I actually didn't like the Beatles. I remember the first thing I really, responding to the British Wave, the first thing that I really was amazed at was my friend Steve singing, walking on a highway in outside Ottawa. We were at a sporting regatta, a canoeing race regatta, in August 1964. And we're walking late at night coming home from a party. And he started singing Time Is On My Side. And he's a musician. He's not a great singer, but he can do it. You know, he can get pretty close song. I thought that was I kept saying, sing it again. Like, for some reason, the song Time Is On My Side, really, I just liked the way it was. And then shortly after that, we saw the Tammy. Do you know the Tammy show?
No.
T.A.M.I. Teenage American International. I think it's one of those American International pictures. Who was that, Roger Corman? Yeah, Roger Corman did those pictures with Dennis Hopper, those Westerns and all that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Someone filmed a concert in Santa Monica Auditorium in 1964-65. I think it was the first time the Stones came over, or first, they weren't really big completely. They were starting to be. And it has everybody in it, and it's highlights. You can, on YouTube, see James Brown does an incredible dance. They'll play that footage, you know, whenever they're talking about James Brown. It had the Stones, it had Jan and Dean, it had everybody. It's the most amazing, fun concert. And when I saw that in a movie theater in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, that I was in. I didn't buy anything, but I think they probably did Time Is On My Side on that. And that was early, seeing rock in film, new rock, rock and roll, whatever. So anyways, being older, you're still detached about it. You're not a kid trying to get an identity out of the music. You know what I mean? You don't have all that relationship issue going on mixed in. That's why it's more than music. It's an environment. And that's why Tim Leary said, whatever music you grew up to, you're conditioned by that. That's a big, important emotional construct in yourself, and because so much of your puberty and early middle adolescence and late teens is mixed in with the music, that's very hard for someone as they get older to respond to other music that way. You've been hooked into it because that's your soundtrack for what you were going through emotionally and physically, right? So
that makes sense to me. Yes.
Right, and Leary said, you know, you're an old fogey if you can't drop that conditioning and get into the new kids' music. Leary was always trying to tune into what was happening, be part of it, to be hip, so to speak. And so he said, if you don't like the 80s music, you're a baby boomer, don't like the 80s music, you're stuck and conditioned by what you grew up with. And he said, you know, to expand your consciousness, get over your emotional identification with a certain period of music and try to hear the new stuff. And that's hard for people. It's hard for people to do. I mean, I remember, you know, since I would go. I'd be in Los Angeles in the 60s doing work for the Secret Council 10. I wasn't chairman at that point. I was a middle-level kind of guy. And I would visit people my age, and I would just – I'd just been visiting Zappa or saw some pop concert. And then I go, and they were my age, but they would play swing music. I always remember going to this one guy's place, and he's always playing swing music. He couldn't hear the new music.
Right, right. He couldn't take it. He didn't know
what to do with it. Yeah, well, he didn't even hear it. He just replayed the swing music. This is in the late 60s. He would play it all the time as a back. When he comes home from work, that's how he'd feel good. He'd play this teenage, for him, his teenage music, which was 30s and 40s jazz, swing jazz. And I used to notice that, you know, he really needed it. It was really a reinforcement, and I saw other people like that. Now, I saw some of that, but I didn't get his condition when I was young. I actually went, you could say I went through my teen conditioning when I was 30s, in my 30s, and came to New York and heard the R&B, which then confuses the issue even more about, well, how old you, maybe it doesn't matter how old you are when you hear this electrified pop music, you know? Anyways, these are the questions that come into this about why you like things.
Too. They're very important questions.
Yeah, they are, because they're the core of your identity. It explains so much human behavior, why people get into arguments, and when a kid starts liking strange music, the parents are threatened by it because they think their teen music was the best music, and it was, but the common factor was they're both electrified. It's the electrification that unifies the generations. But they don't see it that way. They identify with the content. The kid with his new content, the parent with the old content.
I used to get into arguments with a guy at work about the Beatles. He thought, you know, that was basically the be-all, end-all. And the Beach Boys were his favorite. And he hated the sound of hip-hop. He couldn't listen to it. Like, it made him angry.
How old was he? Was he in his 30s at this point, or 20s?
He's in his 50s.
Oh, okay. All right. Right. Yeah. Go ahead.
So he had such an animosity towards any of the new stuff. Like, it made him mad. Like, it angered him.
That's right. The identity crisis. This is a perfect example of what we're talking about. Because think 100 years ago, people did not argue over music like that. They did not have that as part of their identity and make a big issue out of it, right?
Right. No, I don't think so. I mean, it would.
They didn't have as much. They just had their local bar, saloons, or country music, whatever, local natural instruments, not electrified. And there would be the class element. They may not have classical music because that was elite. But a lot of the middle class did educate themselves and their kids in the 19th century with classical music. So it was only a semi-class dividing mark. You know what I mean? But they now, it would be interesting. The composers, they really argue, Beethoven with Mozart and all these guys arguing over what they're doing and what they think to do. They really get into it, right? It's really important. They make sure they don't do Schubert's music, you know, or whatever. They say, no, that goes in the wrong direction, or I don't like Wagner. The composers in that probably were very identified with it, and maybe other people. But to have a 50-year-old arguing with you about what his musical pleasure is ridiculous.
That's what I always thought, yeah.
But it's understandable. It's that's how we know
well,
that
I've
it is
been
important.
There too. I mean, I've had those feelings of weird jealousy or protectiveness and he'd get angry over, like, the new medium, too. Like, he hated MP3s, and he just hated that whole idea, and he liked the his CDs, which didn't make any sense because there's not much difference. I mean, I can see if you like... I know a lot of people like the vinyl, and I can understand that argument, but, like, the CD versus MP3 didn't make any sense. But she was hooked on having that little booklet to look at. And I was thinking, when did they kind of mix the booklet with the song? That's probably something that wasn't invented until... Well, I guess when they started doing sheet music, they would
basically
the cover of
no. It you could say it was always album covers, but you know, with Dylan writing poetry on the back of bringing it all back home or writing stories. I don't recall anybody writing interesting poetry on the with the liner notes, you know. So you'd read the back, and then the art was better, more technology made it easier. So album covers was the beginning of reading booklets, because then Zappa would put a booklet inside the album and it'd have a story or something in it, like an Uncle Meat. Not in all albums, but you would, when Zappa put out something, I'd be disappointed if there wasn't a book or a story within the album. So it wasn't just an ear experience, it was an eye experience too.
Right.
So
this is multimedia.
Multimedia. And then, and of course, then the CDs, I don't buy music. I mean, I'll buy only Zappa or something like that. So I only read Zappa's footnotes, and he'd have good booklets. But other people, I don't know what the booklet said, but it was also too tiny to read almost. But it was, you're saying, you know, it was a common, people like the book, like to read about what they're listening to.
Yeah, and I wonder where that's like a weird thing to me, because like it's not really necessary. It's like, because you have the song, and I think the most honest form of the song is like when it's like I like the MP3 or any electronic format, because you can't hold it in your hand, you can only hold it in your ear.
You like that?
I'm sick of holding shit in my hand, and I'm sick of having a bunch of stuff in the house. I want nothing.
Right. Okay. Now let me.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now I explained this to Ben Watson in our 36 sessions, an hour-long, 55-minute sessions that's on London Radio, and then in with my dialogues with Scott Woods. And this is the essence, the summary. Electricity is a tactile experience, which includes all the senses. So when you listen to music, once it's electrified, say the 50s, 60s, it has to be a tactile experience. It's miming the effect of electricity. And that means the tactile contains all the senses. So that's why McLuhan said rock was not just a musical experience. It was environment. But think of the word environment referring to tactility or all the senses. And that's why people would look. And Zappa used to make fun of the teenagers. He'd make fun of them listening to the album while they fetished the album cover or the photos that came with it. They needed to focus the eye on it as well as hearing it, because the thing was tactile, not just ear, not just eye, but you'd use all the senses. If you get that point, you see what I mean, that's why people like looking and reading magazines and about all this, filling in the acoustic experience, that they thought it was music, but it was actually the electrified environment, which is tactile, which includes all the senses. That's why music in the 60s was not limited to just the ear. It was included gesture and sight and ideology. What you said in your interview was very important if you were a musician. What your position on, it's really funny. You see this footage of Jagger about 1966 being interviewed by British, you know, mainstream 60 Minutes kind of show, and they really want him to explain what the kids are doing, why they act like this, and they're going to him. And so he's serving a iconic function for the scan of the TV landscape, which is covering everything. But when you got to talk about kids, you bring in some figure. So Jagger had this whole spokesman role dumped on him. Like Frank Sinatra didn't have a spokesman role. He didn't have to talk about Vietnam or the Korean War and all that stuff. He wasn't expected to have an opinion. But see, that's back in just the radio age. But when you get into the tactile TV, which includes most of the senses, the content has to cover all the sensory aspects, has to have a point of view, has to be your dancing style, what you eat, how you sound, what are your influences. That's all. It's a whole environment that the consumer gets involved in. They consume the whole person's life as translated in different media. So that's, see, you can get what I'm saying here, right? Basically, you might not agree with it.
I buy that. I mean, I think there's a point. I think it's kind of sad that Sinatra didn't talk about what the kids were doing, though. That would have been interesting.
Oh yeah, but that's later. In the 60s, because every journalism had needed new content, then they started asking John Lennon and Jagger all the stuff. But then they'd always bring in Sinatra, and he got in a lot of trouble in his image by what he said about the Beatles and that. He kind of, if I remember, he said, you know, he put them down. He didn't know that he had to be politically correct or culturally correct. He just gave a stupid little opinion, and it got him in a lot of flack. And you can see him, and by the 70s, 80s, he's a bit cooler about all that, and probably even did a special with David Bowie to prove that he was cool. You know, it's interesting.
Well, I remember the Sinead O'Connor thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that, see, there's the thing. Right, whatever big band is happening right now, or was it Justin somebody, some kid, they have to have an opinion.
They do have to have an opinion, though, don't they?
They have to. They're immediately a representation of the 13 to 16-year-old niche market, you know what I mean? And they've got to represent that. And so that tactile mix is always there for every generation ever since, say, TV started 50, 60 years ago. That is going to happen, and that's what my chart is referring to, the laws of the situation. Every generation will have to go through that mixed media signification, or signifying, to use a semiotics word. You know, John Lennon, what's his name? Justin Bieber or something?
Yeah, something Bieber. It's some Bieber kid. I don't know anything about him. I don't know.
But I saw there was, in the news a year or two ago, there was a riot at a mall in New York City for all these kids. You know, they had to shut down the mall because all these crazed kids, 15-year-olds, were just hicked on. For some reason, this was, you know, the flavor of the week, and they went nuts about it. And then he has to act out all those things. So being a teenage artist is more than just having a good song. You have to be image savvy, and they had advisors to tell them that, and they have to have opinions on religion. And you can see generally, this is why it's a broad outline, their opinions are ear tribal oriented versus eye literate people. They always think their parents are establishment or literate, the old visual bias, and they represent the hip kinetic acoustic bias. That's always a dynamic through the generations the last 50 years. Even though Justin Bieber's parents are totally illiterate or not really literate compared to parents 30 years ago. Do you know what I mean? Like the contrast is absurd. If Gore Vidal or some famous novelist of the 50s, and let's see, who's Thornton Wilder or somebody like that, or Thomas Mann, if they
Norman
saw
Mailer or something?
You know, Mailer was a little more hipper. He studied McLuhan. So, but you know, take a real stick in the mud novelist, very proud. It's his life work. Even you, I don't know what James Joyce.
Like a Glenn Gould type guy.
No. Gould is a student of McLuhan, friend of McLuhan. And we're talking about European novelists or Sinclair Lewis.
Man, if you're listening to one of his things, man, that he's a stick in the mud, I think.
Oh, Gould was, but he was trying to understand McLuhan. He had dialogues. All of us. He quit music in '64 or so. After reading and encountering McLuhan. That's why he dropped out. He said the concert hall is obsolete. And then he would do TV specials and was a TV journalist.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. But then he'd still be presenting this kind of ultra stick in the mud. I like
yeah.
it.
No, you're
it's
right.
Tough.
You're right.
It's entertaining. Yeah.
No, you're right that he wasn't as comprehensive as Zappa. He couldn't. Probably just because he was born too early. But anyways, you take a novelist like Thomas Mann, and he knows who literate people in 1940s are versus semi-literate or non-literate. If he looked at Justin Bieber, and he's against the literate, and he looks at Justin criticizing his parents, who would be born maybe in the 80s or something, you know, and he'd see, well, they're fighting against the parents, and they're supposed to represent the establishment. And Thomas Mann looked at the parents of Justin Bieber. He would say, that woman has not read a book in 25 years. And I don't know if it's true, but it's an example. Thomas Mann's standards of being literate would have long disappeared by 1970. And so anybody who's representing literate values, as parents are supposed to do in American culture, would not even qualify to be a guardian of it.
I see.
But Justin,
yeah.
But
yeah,
but
it's like if I had a kid, like I could have a kid in his teens now, and it would be if he was rebelling against my generation, which as being like the old guard of like the culture, the stick in the
yeah.
mud, but it's like it's spurious because it's not true.
Right.
Because we are illiterate. I don't even remember what was the last literate generation.
That's right. The baby boomers were the last literate generation, and they're in their 60s now, late 50s, early 60s. They're grandpeople, right? Grandparents.
You saw the
generation
X. Here's the thing.
People read more books than ever, but it is not a formative thing as it was before World War II. It was important. A new book was a major event among the major authors. That's McLuhan was to talk about that. And he saw by the 60s that books weren't a major event. Now they're just, you know what books are today, in my experience, they're just things that people read on the beach.
Yeah, or on the way to work.
Yeah, on the way to work in subways. But I'm amazed that all these people on the beach I go to every day, they're all reading books because they're going to be baking in the sun for many hours, so they don't want to just lie there, so they read books. You say, oh, look, people read books illiterate. No, it's not. It's candy. What really forms them, because while they're reading their book, every now and then they check their little iPhone or little hand computer to see what's really important, what the emails are saying. Do you know what I mean?
I don't think you can go back.
Yeah, you can't go back. No, you can't. Unless you... It's interesting. If you did turn everything off completely, not right away, but within a generation or so, if you had no major technologies, it would be different people. But it would take a generation or two because people would have the memory of it for a generation or two.
For me, I think I probably spend 5% of my time reading and then like 20% watching movies or TV, 20% playing video games as far as when it comes to media.
Right.
The other part, listening to music or like people speaking, you know, like audio. So I think like I've never been a huge reader.
That's
I
for
like
most
reading.
People, that is.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's kind of.
See, I'm a literate person.
I don't know what it is, but it is, I guess.
Yeah, Kurt, I'm a literate person. You know, I grew up in the 20s, 30s, 40s. I'm conditioned by that. Therefore, I'm more left hemisphere instinctively. And therefore, I'm articulate. And, like, I can talk about any issue because of my literacy.
Well, you're somewhat
you're not,
articulate.
Beg your pardon?
I'm just messing with you.
What'd you say?
But nobody, I said you're somewhat articulate. I mean, it's like the words sound good coming out of your mouth, but I think a lot of people don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, because it's too literate. It's too connected. Yeah, like if you listen to my timeline and you've listened to the Mike Dyer stuff late 80s, early 90s, what is funny is Bob is being a speaker of prose in style and the content is bizarre in a non-literate medium. That's why I'm laughing a lot.
That's what it is. That's the perfect summation. That's what you should have on your tombstone if you ever die, which you may not.
Yeah, which I probably won't. But no, I'm glad you get it. Now that you get it, you won't forget that. You know this. That's the summation. That's what's going on here. And now here's another thing. The radio world, McLuhan said, it was a hot medium, so it favored the prose and the literary talk. And then TV came in and didn't favor the prose, and that's why the culture changed. So radio was the perfect medium to do in the 80s to do the prose talk I did. Now, not only was it prose, I was talking and explaining what I'm saying right now in the show. I was explaining why you couldn't understand me. Because I was in the wrong medium. That's what's going on there.
That's good.
Get it. You get it. Yeah. Now you get it.
It's another level. Once again.
Another level. And that's why your friends say, why are you talking to this Bob guy? The key thing is talking. We don't want to talk. We don't want some meaningful prose statement. We just want you and Greg or your friend to just sort of say little sound bites and joke and play some music and mix it up. Don't make me have to pay attention to a sentence that's leading somewhere. And that's why they're saying that. What? Why are you talking about? Why are you doing this prose stuff with Bob? You know, they're saying it's the wrong medium, Kurt. It's the wrong medium. You should not be doing Bob on your show. It's the wrong medium for Bob.
and that's why you have to do Bob.
That's right. I'm the only museum of literate values left, and I'm not even dedicated to it. I just can put it on.
That's good. Yeah, because I can never read. I can't. I don't know. It's like I can't comprehend it. But when I hear you talking it, I get it.
It doesn't stay though. And now this gets back to what we're talking about. Music. It's the same thing. Nothing stays, you know, in television. You know, most people. McLuhan used to talk about this. They said there were studies done in the '60s. He would say this in the '70s. Where they would get people to say what they just watched on TV. You know, they might watch a news broadcast, and then like 2 minutes later, 5 minutes later, the scientists would come in and sociologists would come in. Okay, what did you see? Mostly they couldn't remember what they just saw.
Well, I can never know what shows are about.
You're saying you can?
Yeah, I can, and I'm participating.
No, what you're saying you can, not cannot. You can remember shows when you're involved in them.
No, I can't half the time. It's like I'm in the zone, and it's like...
That's because the medium is numbing your left hemisphere, your non-narrative part of your brains, and your left narrative, linear connected prose logic part of your brain is weakened when you're watching TV. That's what it really... The people can remember. They know they saw, you know, Nixon gave a press conference or some footage of Vietnam. They know the visual iconography, the photography stuff, but they can't put it into an opinion about it. They can't organize it and say, well, this is what I learned from it. You don't jump. When you go jump in the water and swim around, when you come out, you don't say, hey, Kurt, what'd you learn from that one? What'd you learn from that little swim in the pool? And you say, I don't learn nothing. I'm just immersing myself. That's what's happening. You're immersing yourself, but it's also zapping your brain, your left hemisphere, so you can't remember. You don't even see a purpose to translate it into prose.
That's why that's why something like porn would probably be the best medium.
Yeah,
best content.
Yeah, it's tactile, kinetic.
It's the most honest content.
It's proprioceptive. It involves sensitive interaction between people, including their innards, which is the proprioceptive sense. So the most powerful content on television is there's a proprioceptive material or presentation because that's the closest to the tactile sense, which is not a sense, the tactile interplay. So the closest is proprioceptive because you're trying to get your balance and you're feeling your inner guts and whatever's inside you. All that is close to the juggling that we imagine the tactile interplay does, because tactility interplays the sensory data and it organizes consciousness. The most intimate sense, particular sense that approximates what we intuit by tactility is the proprioceptive, and pornography is proprioceptive. That's where people are inside each other's innards and massages and caressing and all that. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's the porn is the most appropriate imagery, the most effective content for the digital age. And it took over. It's natural. Natural it took over.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it, so I think that's the and it's and when so and when you finish watching a porno, you know people you're not asked what was that about or
Yeah, you're not asked to give a prose statement about or any aspect of prose thinking. You could say, how does this relate to your church? How does it relate to your kids? How does this relate to the war in Iraq? You know, all those journalistic topics, they're not relevant. As a matter of fact, basically the thing is supposedly an escape from thinking. It's an escape from thinking. But it's not – you're thinking in your right hemisphere or your tactile interplay way of thinking, not linear prose thinking. See, that's the hypocrisy of our time is that we base – our society and our education on ancient literate values that is so gone, it's not really part of our life. That's why I call it a meme. It's an after image of literacy that people are propping up.
Right, because there's really no one, there's no literate, there's nobody, those people are gone.
That's right. If you go back and look at 19th century newspapers, they're incredible. people write, you know, many, many inches of column space to state their position on maybe a local bill in London or something. You know, but they have all this time, so they do it all writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. You know, and you couldn't believe, you wouldn't even have time to read it, and you would be amazed that they had time to write it, and you wouldn't be able to follow it. It'd just be too convoluted.
Yeah, it is. I can't follow. I've looked at some of that, and I'm always blown away by, like, even the, design of the pages or the ads they would have had all those little flourishes.
Yep.
And they were super detailed, and it was always very...
a lot of work and craftsmanship.
Yeah, that's just so that's lacking now. And it's been replaced by
non-visual. You know, people are still working as hard. They just don't work in a dingy, you know, smoke-filled editorial office with a lot of ink on their hands back in the 19th century. Now what are they doing? They're doing maybe 3 porno movies a day. I mean, they're making them. They're sitting around. They're getting hungry while they're waiting for Betty to screw Billy. And then it's their turn to blow Nancy. And it requires, you know, and there's work there. You got to sit there and pay attention and be ready for whatever has to be done. It's still the constricted expression of energy. That's always what work is. You know what I mean? It's you got to follow this routine. You can't digress too much. So the work aspect still continues in the human condition, you know, the sweat of the brow, but it's done for proprioceptive reasons now, for proprioceptive entertainment, not for eye entertainment. So it's not you can say replace, but you got to – I mean, remember, McLuhan meant by obsolete that it's that there's a lot of it. When he said books were obsolete, he meant they did not form people's sensibility anymore, but there was more and more to fill in the gap of the real thing that they were experiencing, the tactile massage. So this is being the grammarian. Let's be careful what we mean by obsolete. Know that when we're talking about it, if we're going to use McLuhan, it doesn't mean what people think obsolete means. And McLuhan said that obsolescence was obsolete. Think of that thing. Planned obsolescence was obsolete. That means there's a lot of planned obsolescence going on.
Because you can throw on any one of these environments you want to whenever you feel like it in this age.
Yeah. Now think of this. Planned obsolescence is obsolete. So that means there's a lot of planned obsolescence going on. That is shown in the social mores. By the time Generation Xers are getting married, they're putting all kinds of clauses in their marriage deals, anticipating divorce and all that. They are planning on the obsolescence of the marriage at some point.
That's true, yes.
You may not have done that, but a lot of people did, and they're anticipating the effects. They know that whatever they're doing is probably obsolete, in a sense, finished. So they prepare their conditions in relation to that future condition. And that's everywhere. So that's planned obsolescence is obsolete, meaning everybody's doing planned obsolescence. And then planned obsolescence could be another way to describe pollution. If something's obsolete, then there's a lot of it. So... The pollution is just planned, unplanned obsolescence, uncontrolled obsolescence. Anyways, you can get into a lot of word games with this and different meanings, but on the verbal entertainment level, that's what McLuhan did. He always used words and used them in the opposite from the normal sense.
Now, Bob, we've already been on 45 minutes, and I can only do an hour today, though.
That's all right, but the thing is, let's go back. See, this is the main thing, is what is it that I'm experiencing when I like music? I think Zappa is the greatest, but I don't listen to him much, and I don't listen to this and that. But I'll do, at night, if I'm doing something, washing the dishes or something, which I do, I clean up the house at the end of the day because Karen goes to bed earlier than me. And I like that because I can hear our shows replayed, but I listen to music, and it's all great for the moment, but I almost don't need it. If it wasn't there, I wouldn't need it. But I think about why people get so opinionated about it, especially when they're young. They get very opinionated about who's performing.
Right. And why is that?
Because the ear, every sense, since the tactile interplay is not a sense, and we're in a tactile environment, especially during the Android meme, that means any one sense becomes archetypal. It becomes a big deal. And so the ear, in the 19th century, not a big deal, but in our time, the ear becomes a big deal for young people, and who they're listening to is a big matter of identity. It's almost religious, the way people were, you know, 150 years ago. Each sense becomes archetypal. What movies they like, that's the kinetic sense, is very important. What books they might read or claim to read are important. Every sense got fragmented and became the source of archetypal identity. Now, that's a very big statement, very profound, but totally accurate if you know what I mean. The ear, you see, that's McLuhan's point. The old environment becomes art form, becomes archetypal, a lot of emotional values put into it. So the ear and the eye as separate cultural products, and the cultural products associated with the eye and the ear, become what people fight over. Like the culture wars of the 80s, you know, the Christians said, you know, no more of this evolution, Darwin, and pornographic stories. We're going to have these kind of novels, clean novels. That was very important to figure that out and state your position on it in if you're on the school faculty. And why? And they're fighting over what is obsolete. In other words, there's a lot of separate ear and eye experiences in the media, but nobody can handle the tactility, the black hole of tactility. And
wow,
now it's come. And
I'm starting to feel like that Harold Shander guy right now.
Harold will be famous. Just say, because I'll be probably the most famous artist of our time in the long run. Harold Shander will be made famous because he did all those interviews with me. People will look at him.
I feel like Harold Shander right now because I feel like, I mean, not to put him down, but I always feel like there's a guy that doesn't know what the hell you're talking about.
Right. He met McLuhan. He was a great fan of Bucky Fuller, and he loved Bucky Fuller is his main guru. So I always played McLuhan off versus his Fuller, and he couldn't take it. But he was really good. He could understand what I was referring to. Most people don't even know what I'm referring to. But he was old enough and studied enough and literate enough, but he was a stick in the mud. He is a stick in the mud. He only has one point. He wants to spread the word of Lewis Kelso's binary economics. That's his agenda. So what was funny about me interacting, I would put on that I was there for the McLuhan agenda. If you knew me, I'm not just a McLuhan, but it's the most useful thing to use because people, it relates to reality, but it relates to known reality. LaRouche, not so much, you know. LaRouche, the people say, well, they just get distracted by LaRouche's apparent image. But McLuhan, you can apply to any situation. It's interesting to people to hear their sensory life described to them. And so you had me putting on a McLuhan fanaticism versus his Louis Kelso fanaticism. And it's a very sophisticated conversation. But you're right. He definitely loses to me because he can't get into what I'm doing. I can get into what he's doing. And if he wants to beat me, he has to be able to know and understand my side of it that he can bounce off knowingly with it. You know what I mean?
So do you always feel that your interactions are a competition?
I don't feel that with you. It depends on the person. He makes it competitive. He has an agenda. I knew he had an agenda, so I said, okay, I'll have an agenda back at you.
How many times have you been on the Harold Shander show?
I think it's about 10. Most of them are on, you know, on my timeline. It's about 10 shows. I did one just before I came to Maui 2 years ago. That was the last one. And I haven't been back there to do it.
I like listening to that guy. That guy, there's something about him I like. I don't know what
it is. Well, that's because he is one of the most literate people and knowledgeable people in media. He's interviewed, I don't know, 2,000 people. I mean, everybody from Henry Kissinger to your mother, you know. The thing is that, and they're all very interesting for the semi-literate person, the semi-educated, sophisticated person. They're all worth listening to. He has every kind of person on there. It's a great archive. But, you know, push comes to shove and you want to deal with the present, and that's what he's not capable of dealing with from my opinion level. And that's all. Though, I mean, he knew after we did a show, he always said, Bobby, you're the only guy who understands me. He said, you're the only guy who understands me. No, I used to call him up. He was a good friend. I used to go to his New Year's Eve parties. No, famous middle of December. Everybody would show up because he is very well known in all levels of New York society because he's interviewed so many people. He's been there since late 60s, 40 years. He guess who lives in his building? Ornette Coleman.
No shit, really.
Yeah, I re-met Ornette Coleman through Harold Channer. I visited Coleman when he was on Prince or Spring Street down in Soho in 73 or so. That's when I first went over to his place and talked to him. Then I saw him do a great Carnegie concert, one of the greatest I've ever experienced that period. It was during the New York Newport, when they merged New York Newport Jazz Festival. Anyways, but I had not seen Ornette Coleman from 73 till 2000, you know, 27 years. And there I'm sitting there in Harold's place. I'm just getting to know Harold in October 2000. And there's this black guy over there talking to other people, older guy. And I'm talking away with Giorgio Gomelsky. That's where I met Giorgio Gomelsky, the guy who created the Rolling Stones and that whole story. He's a great cultural figure. And he's the one who was the advisor, Gomelsky, on the Yardbirds movie, Blow Up, is it? Yeah, Blow Up, in the movie Blow Up by Antonioni. Anyways, the black guy says, he looks over at me at some point. I've been yakking away with Giorgio, and he must have been listening. He says, who are you? And I said, Bob. And then he said something. I said, who are you? And he's walking towards me, and he said, Ornette. And I looked at him. Couldn't believe it. I said, you're Ornette Coleman? You look so different. You know, he's old and wizened, so skinnier and all that. And I said, wow, I met you 30 years ago. And so we got talking. Do you know this story? Have I told you?
No, you haven't.
Yeah. We get talking, and I start, as I always do, I test them, bring in Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan to see if he knows, see if he understands what's happening. And as soon as I brought in that stuff, he kind of agreed, and then he started explaining his harmonics to me. And then I was translated back in McLuhan, so it was a very, you know, unique conversation. And he says, we need to talk more, because he had to go back or leave the party. He said, we need to talk more, and he gave me his number. So about a week later, I called him, and I left a long continuation of our discussion on his phone, and he never got back to me. And then I found out a week or so later from Harold Channer that he had crushed his hand, like just after the party. And he was laid up for a year, really bad, you know. Probably had those wires in his fingers and that. He just hurt his hand somehow really badly. So that's probably why we never connected, because he was hurt and then laid up. And then I would hear from Harold, you know, how long it was taking to heal. So I didn't bother him. He didn't call him up, all right? So then that's 2000. In 2008, one of the last times I do Harold, it might have been the last one, we're going to go over the McLuhan article, A Media Approach to Inflation, done from New York Times, an op-ed in 1974, September 1974. It's an amazing article. Predicts all that happens in the 80s and 90s. And so Harold needs to read it before we interview. So I go over to his place Friday afternoon, and he ain't there. And I got to leave it to somebody. So I'm looking at, you can't get up the elevator to these levels of apartment, but I'm looking in the lobby, and there's the newspapers for the tenants, and I see Ornette Coleman's newspaper, New York Times, and I see which number he is. So, you know, which apartment he is. So I said, I can drop it off to Ornette. So I go back outside, buzz the door to come in, buzz his apartment, and someone says, who is it? I say, let me in, as if, you know, I should be allowed in. So I go in, and I get on the elevator, and I can't go up the elevator because it's all locked in. So eventually the guy up there realizes that I can't get up, so he has to come down to pick me up, you know what I mean, to take me up. So he comes down, we go back up, and I'm handing – and then we go into the front door of the apartment, and it's like totally empty room, and I can hear Ornette rehearsing off in the corner. And I said, look, I got to give this to Harold. Please, he's away for the weekend. Give it to him on Monday for my interview with Harold. And the guy didn't really know what I was talking about, so I showed it to him and said, look, this is McLuhan. You ever heard of McLuhan? No. He said, this is an op-ed for 1974. It's important. As a matter of fact, if Ornette gets time this weekend, he should read this before he gives it to Harold. So I gave his, you know, the gopher all these instructions about this Xeroxing of a McLuhan thing, and he said he would give it to Ornette. And so then I left. He said I'd let you talk to Ornette, but he's rehearsing right now. I said, oh, yeah, that's all right. I wasn't here to talk to Ornette. So that was my last communique to Ornette. And so when I did Harold's thing the next week, I said, did you get the article from Ornette? Did you read it? He said, no, I didn't bother him. I found it in my own office, so I read it. So that was my last convoluted involvement with Ornette. I don't know if he read the McLuhan article.
Oh, man.
And,
well, man, I originally wanted to do the Lost discussion.
Yeah, there's a lot. We did it. Hey, listen to last week's cash flow. In the first hour at howionic.com, listen to Ion and me and Carolyn and James talking about Lost. And then we can go from there. So in other words, you got to do a little bit of homework before we get into this.
All right, I will do some homework then.
I will send you
show.
The link. I will send you the actual hour link. You just click on it and hear the first hour where we go into detail about Lost. And we're led by, you know, Ion's an expert on Lost, and he fills in a lot of stuff about it.
Okay, that'll be good.
What did you think of the ending?
I don't know what the hell happened, but I liked it.
You liked it. Okay, you're not unhappy with it.
No, not at all.
Okay, so we didn't get to the interview, but this is all relevant. This is all other stuff. It's all part of this.
It's a journey, Bob.
Yeah, it's a journey.
It's
and but we need to stay. We beg your pardon?
The endless interview.
Right, but we need to stay on this point about what the heck is this electric effect where even the greatest music, you can drop it and go on to something else, and that you're actually being stimulated by the electric effect more than the content. See, the medium is the message more than the content. That's what McLuhan's getting at. This may not be 100% true, but it's a major factor in why people act the way they do today. Why a 50-year-old is really pissed that he can't make it with the hip-hop stuff, which becomes the dominant meme, and he's made to be marginal because of that, and he's pissed about it.
Yeah, he's flipping out.
Yeah. And yet, even this, it doesn't matter that he can't get with it. He's got a lot of Beatles and Beach Boys to listen to. You know, there's a lot of stuff that huge amounts of stuff that he can stay lost in his matrix hole, you know, his rabbit hole.
That's the point. So why does he give a shit?
Yeah, but I call that the after image of a public space. People still think that there's some public space that needs to have law and order and some shared consensus reality. That's our public identity. You know, like, we can't give
that
up totally. Yeah, we cannot give that, even though if you look around, who the hell has a public identity anymore? There's lots of fragmented niche versions of public identity, but there's no standardized one. And yet we will try to standardize. We'll say, no, this is bad. Hip-hop's bad. The kids are getting stupider. You know, it's just violent, gangster, all this, you know, stuff. And they think there's an area of common values that is being threatened by the anarchy of hip hop or the terrible quality of the music. And yet you can be outraged all you want. You can't stop it because hip hop resonates with the mass effect of the media texture of the day, and the kids are going to like it no matter what.
It's true.
So you can't stop it, and then you got to figure, well, what's my identity in relation to something that I can't control? And then you say, well, why am I so worried about music? They think it's music. And then you have to realize, oh, yeah, my whole identity is invested in my ear. My ear is my archetypal ID.
Yeah. And I've been struggling with that for a while. And I think I'm coming around the corner with that.
Yeah, you've been wondering about why people are like that.
And wondering why I get so upset about things that really have no effect on me. That, you know, the, like, why it's such an important part of my life, and why do I feel like and this actually is in the interview that we did, like, I kind of touched on a little bit, is like, where does that sense of ownership of, like, a band that you're into come from?
That's your ID. That's your archetypal ear. Now, here's where you bring in the Church Sub Genius. They make entertainment a big deal, and in sense they'll go, okay, I want the total fringe stuff that no one knows about. I want the bad stuff that nobody likes. There's that thing. But they generally are indifferent to it all. It's all just swill, you know, something to drink.
Right.
But what's limited about that, and that's right, they're a tactile cult. They're trying to act out tactile indifference. Tactility is not any particular sense or any particular thing. So they try to be totally different from what you're saying if you're trying to make a point. Now, they are right from the tactile position, but they can't explain why they're in the right position. They're unwittingly, by default, from the same appropriate manipian position about cultural garbage. And yet, but they don't know why that is. That's where I came in. That's why I'm a senior epop of the church. I can explain why they have the attitude they have.
And see, and that's why we're doing this show, because you need to explain it.
Yeah.
People need to know.
It helps them get a handle. I'm not saying it's the truth or the final thing. I'm telling you, this is a major aspect of looking at your public reality that has got a lot of work done to it that will help you get a little more balanced about it, or a little more slack or poise. Yeah, in that sense, it's important to know. It's like McLuhan said, I have the correct questions. These are questions. We're talking affirmatively, you know, and aggressively, but it's really leading to questions, which I'm always probing. So McLuhan said, 20th century man has all the answers, but he doesn't know what the questions are. McLuhan felt he had the best questions to figure out what the problems are, or even if you could have a problem.
All right. Well, I'll do my homework. We'll continue this next week. Are you going to be around next week, next Monday, same time?
Yeah, always check with me, but probably.
Okay.
And
all right,
and
Bob,
don't forget to go to informationfarm.blogspot.com for a lot of updates on really good ionic things that are being excerpted by Ed over there.
All right.
I'll send you the URL.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we'll talk to you next
time. Okay, great.
Time.
Okay, Kurt. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.